Welcome to Talkless Water, a podcast that takes a deep dive into the world of water with those making waves. My name is Todd Butler, and I'm your host for Talkless Water. I'm also the principal of Collaborative Water Resolution, which you can find at waterdisputes.org. And in addition, I'm editor-in-chief of Texasless Water and a Texas Water Journal. Both publications are free. My guest today is Kerrigan Burke. Kerrigan Burke is an acting professor of law at the University of California, Davis School of Law. Kerrigan graduated from Stanford Law School in 2009 and completed his PhD dissertation in ecology at UC Davis in 2011. He clerked for 10th Circuit Chief Judge Mary Beck Briscoe, U.S. District Court Judge Julie Robinson, and Judge Janice Carlin on the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Kansas. Kerrigan's publications run the gamut from the definitive text on the history and application of California Fish and Game Code on minimum releases for stream flow below dams to a hatchery and genetic management plan for spring run Chinook salmon. He's currently examining legal and ethical issues in ecological restoration. His past work has focused on the management of guest species, those invasive species that managers invite in and make comfortable, on the evolution of law via administrative actions. He is currently working on local governance issues and ecosystem management. Kerrigan, welcome and thank you for being part of Talkless Water.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me in.
So, your background in the law and ecology, I thought you'd be a perfect person to talk to you about wetlands. But let's start out first with your background in water. Tell us, when do you first kind of decided, hey, I want to make my career, somewhat around water or focus on water, or what kind of special, moment in your life said, hey, water is something that I'm really interested in?
Yeah. Thanks for the question. So I guess, the first ornament I have from the year I was 1 year old is a fish ornament that my parents got for me. I grew up in Lawrence, Kansas, and spent just a ridiculous amount of my childhood outside playing in streams, playing in the woods, getting dirty, getting muddy, catching crawdads and frogs and fish and all that stuff. My granddad had a collection of native fish in his basement, and I went fishing with my dad just about every weekend. So basically, as far back as I can remember, I knew I wanted to work on water issues. I thought I was just going to work on the biology side. I'd go to grad school and become a conservation biologist and tromp around in streams with a net and catch fish all day. And then I went to Trout Unlimited in DC for a summer and realized kind of no matter how good your science is, you need a legal framework to implement it, to make changes in the way we manage our water. And after that, I figured I probably needed to combine some kind of law background with the science that I was already wanting to do. And so that's what I've kind of spent the last, 20, 30 years doing is finding a way to meld those two different areas.
I love it. So, I grew up fishing and waterfowl hunting. Water's big in both, right? And got very interested in that and then went to graduate school, then went to DC right out of, I was still in graduate school and had a short stint as a graduate researcher at the EPA in their wellness program. And so, kind of the same thing, I was thinking about how, public policy is really important in a way that, I hadn't really experienced before and, kind of started thinking that, whatever I do, I'd love to find a way to combine public policy and science. So
that's great.
Good deal. So, as I mentioned, you're the ideal person to talk about wetlands and the Clean Water Act with your background. And so, this is a really broad kind of opening question, but, can you kind of walk us through kind of the history, the effort on the federal level to protect the nation's wetlands? What's that look like?
Yeah, sure. So it's funny. Most of the time, the federal government has, throughout our history, has actually been focused on destruction of wetlands, not wetland protection. That was always the goal. We started kind of when European colonization first started happening in the United States and in what's now the United States, not including Alaska. We had about 221 million acres of wetlands. About 103 left by the 1980s, depending on who you ask, which federal agency you talk to, there's somewhere around 75 million up to maybe 100 million acres now. So we're well under half what we had historically. Six states have lost 85% or more of their wetlands. California's down to about 10% of our historic wetlands. Texas is in that 50 to 85% wetland loss range. There's 20 some states that have lost 50% or more of their wetlands. So most of what we've seen is just a huge destruction of wetlands. Somebody did the math, and it's about 60 acres of wetlands for every hour from 1780 to 1980, which is really a remarkable rate of wetland destruction. You don't get that by accident, right? That's kind of the result of a view of wetlands as these swampy, terrible places where your wagon gets stuck, your horse gets stuck, where you catch diseases that are going to kill you or kill your kids, that make it really hard to get out natural resources and just generally aren't very useful.
Right. I've got those great quotes. You've probably seen them from, colonial days where the British are talking about the foul dams of the wetlands and, causing diseases and wishing they had more rum with them and all that. Yeah.
I've been on those trips where the rum is the only way to make it through the wetland for sure. So that's, that's what we had for a long time. And so the effort was just to get rid of these wetlands kind of as fast as we could. A lot of draining of coastal wetlands, draining wetlands for towns initially. And then you start to see the federal government really getting in on it in like the 1840s through maybe the 1850s, 1860s with these swamp land acts. And that's where the federal government says that, hey, states, you can have the swamp and overflow lands in your state to sell to make money for the state if you require people to drain those lands in order to get control of them. Kind of like the Homestead Act or some of the federal desert land acts. It's part of this effort to give away federal lands, but this is focused on getting these swamps drained. And that led to the drainage of about 65 million acres, 20 million acres of that in Florida and the Everglades, right? So the government's really pushing this. And then it starts getting faster and bigger as we see mechanization of agriculture starting in the 1870s, 1880s, some of the steam engine stuff, construction of drainage tiles, which are really vital for farming in some of these wet places, lock and dam kind of navigation systems you see along the Mississippi River. So you see kind of an acceleration of the loss of wetlands in that era. Riparian habitats just take a huge beating with channelization, with construction of levees and kind of constricting of floodplains. Estimates say we've lost about 70% of those riparian habitats in the United States. And then by the 1930s, 1940s, you got the federal government sharing the cost of the drainage projects and doing a lot of the engineering work. And ag, by this point, becomes the really big push, knocking out about 80% of the wetlands. So, I mean, it's just a massive effort to drain these wetlands. But you're starting to see by like 1890s, like the World Fair in 1892 had, you start to see people who are, we're realizing we're starting to lose a whole lot of species. It's funny you mentioned the waterfowl hunting earlier. I do some deer hunting and did some duck hunting and when we lived back in Kansas, but I could never shoot enough ducks to make up for the calories I burned staying warm. But these hunting groups that you started to see kind of coming around the 1880s, 1890s, were getting concerned because a lot of their game animals were disappearing. Right, so you get the Lacey Act the federal government passes in 1900, trying to reduce trafficking of game taken illegally. You get the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918, I mentioned the World's Fair in 1892. That was because you had Lewis Lindsay Dyke, who was a professor at KU, who'd constructed a big diorama with all these animals that people thought were going to go extinct. And so people were encouraged, go to the World's Fair, see the, you know, the stuffed moose and the stuffed deer and the stuffed bear before these animals disappear from North America.
Oh, wow.
And so it's a real feel.
So early. I'd never imagined that, you know, that there was a focus that early.
Yeah, I think it's part of that whole, like, the West is closing. We're really starting to use up resources. It's the same time we start establishing national parks and national forests. There seems to be kind of a general realization kind of across the country that these resources aren't limited, right? That we're able to run out of these things. So 1920s. Bird populations are going way down. People start getting concerned about having enough birds to hunt. And so they start working to conserve the places that the birds need to survive. And the biologists at the time, not a lot of them, but there's some game managers who start saying, hey, we really need these wetlands. These wetlands are the key places to produce these bird populations. So Congress starts setting aside land to protect wetlands. Some of the like central flyway wetlands up in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, sets up some national parks or wildlife refuges rather up there. So you're essentially creating some protected places for these wetlands. And then in 1934, Congress creates the Migratory Bird Hunting Stamp Act. This is the one that makes us buy that stamp every year before you can start hunting the migratory birds.
Which they don't, you don't give you a stamp anymore.
Oh, they don't. I haven't bought one.
you get one eventually, but now you just get a number. Now, I just got mine. And, you know, you in a month, then they send you the stamp. And like, so they used not to be the way it is. You had to have that stamp. And so I haven't figured out, you know, why the delay is, because you think with our levels of technology that we would not have that kind of a delay. But I don't know. There's some reason.
You used to be able to just buy it and get it at the post office or wherever you're buying your stamp. Yeah.
Right.
Well, so the money from that goes to acquiring wildlife habitat. And a lot of that is wetlands. So that was the first time we actually start like restoring wetlands, and the federal government's getting in on the act of trying to put these wetlands back that we've been draining and getting rid of. Right. So we see kind of a conflict developing in federal policy there. The other piece of this that was really interesting, in 1937, we get that Wildlife Restoration Act. People know it as the Pittman-Robertson Wildlife Restoration Act. And that essentially is all of these sportsmen, sportswomen, right? Everybody, all the hunters who are taxing themselves in order to support conservation. And that is just a huge part and still is a huge part of the funding for habitat protection. So it's about $27 billion over the history of that one, plus a sports fishing fund. State expenditures match it to another $9 billion. So you're looking like $36 billion over the life of that program to protect habitat. And a lot of that has gone into protection of wetland habitat. All right. So before we even get to the Clean Water Act, there is this recognition that like this habitat's actually important. We need to maybe stop destroying all of it. And we need to save some of it so that we can get all of the benefits that these wetlands bring to us. And I think that's kind of part of this broader recognition that the wetlands are doing really important things for us. Right. Wetlands are not only providing the habitat for these ducks that people and geese that people want to hunt, but all kinds of aquatic and terrestrial plants and animals use wetlands as rearing habitat. They do all kinds of good things for us for flood protection, water quality improvement, erosion control, recreation, aesthetics. They're pretty. You know, we tend to think of them now as something that's pretty, not a dank miasma. And then all kinds of natural products that are produced in these. You know, I grew up thinking about wetland as the place where you'd see cattails. But, you know, I think there's a lot of these wetlands that are timber wetlands that have trees growing throughout them. And those timber resources can be really valuable. And so that was the realization kind of coming through in the 60s, early 70s. People start to recognize these are really important. And then we get the Clean Water Act passed in 1972. And that contains a section called Section 404, And that says if you're going to discharge dredged or fill materials into the waters of the United States, you have to have a permit to do that. And that isn't kind of clearly aimed at wetlands. Initially, it may have been conceived more as a navigation piece. And it was originally and still is given to the Corps of Engineers to administer that part of the act. So the EPA does the most of the other parts of the Clean Water Act, but the Corps of Engineers does this piece probably because they have that navigation expertise that kind of drove this initially. But as the environmentalists are kind of recognizing how vital these wetlands are, the Clean Water Act becomes the way to protect these things. So Carter issues an executive order in 1977, the federal agencies to try and avoid impacts to wetlands. President Bush, the first one in 1988, issues a no net loss policy, saying that we are not going to destroy wetlands. So any wetlands that get destroyed, that get permitted under the Clean Water Act to destroy or to fill those wetlands, you have to replace those wetlands with new wetlands. The Clinton administration kind of leans into that. Then the second Bush administration continues that same policy and says we're going to not just do like replacement on an acre-by-acre basis, but we're actually going to do a functional replacement. So the functions that we lose when wetlands get filled are going to have to be replaced at new ones or by new wetlands as we go. And so that's, you know, it's become clear, you know, even if the Clean Water Act wasn't aimed at protecting these wetlands, you can't accomplish all the other goals of the Clean Water Act unless you can protect these wetlands. And so that's become the primary mechanism at the federal level to protect wetlands.
So I remember when I, what year was that? I guess 88, when I was there at the EPA in DC working on these wetlands issues. And I was reading all these cases and learning, you know, that history about the Clean Water Act. And, you know, the one thing that I was, you know, kind of struck with was, well, you know, a lot of the opponents for Section 404 are, you know, kind of hanging their hat on this, hey, this was not created to protect wetlands. Whether it's not clear to me whether, you know, the some of the drafters weren't thinking that, though, that's what it was going to do. But it seemed like, you know, there was a lot of, you know, kind of angst about, or, you know, really some consternation about, well, this is not what we thought this program was going to do. But which is, I think, you know, something that that's kind of troubled the program a little bit. I mean, along the way. But the other thing that I've always thought is been kind of an issue is you do have like two agencies that implement it, and they're not always on the same page. I think they're on the same page now, but they haven't always been in the past. And, you know, the Corps' mission really is, you know, was not an environmental mission. It was really focused on navigation and, you know, transportation infrastructure and a lot of other things. And so, you know, they're transitioning into more of an environmental role. I think still transitioning. And so that's something that I've always been, you know, interested in as part of that whole debate is, you know, kind of the, you know, those institutions were changing and, you know, one had a certain point of view about wetlands and the other was maybe this is something that we've kind of inherited that we, you know, really didn't originally think this is what we might be doing.
Yeah, you know, initially they had the EPA and the Corps right after the Clean Water Act was passed had different versions of how they define the waters of the United States, the waters that are covered by the Clean Water Act. And then pretty quickly, Corps of Engineers came in line with EPA's definition, which includes those wetlands. And then the Corps has been since then kind of just as aggressive as EPA about delineating these jurisdictional areas. The act itself, like the language of the act says, it seeks to restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. And you're a water scientist, you know this yeah. stuff, but you can't do that if you don't protect wetlands as part right. of that. And folks knew that in the 1970s when this was passed. And the other part that's kind of interesting is the EPA actually has a veto authority over those Corps of Engineers permits. So they don't exercise it very often, but from the very beginning, there's been an environmental piece, kind of oversight piece of what the Corps has been able to do.
Well, I remember those few times that they had exercised that authority. It was always a very big deal. And it was usually had to do with like some big marina or something that was going to be built in, you know, wetlands and, you know, mangrove, you know, wetlands or something in Florida or someplace else. But that was always a huge deal. And so, you know, thinking about that program, you know, the ever-changing definition that, you know, the EPA and the Corps had to deal with has been one of the features. As you mentioned, WOTUS, Waters of the United States, you know, when I was there in D.C., there was a manual called the, essentially called the 1987 Wetlands Delineation Manual. And, you know, that manual had the specific guidance in it, which was used to determine which parts of the landscape, you know, were wetlands and whether subject to regulation under the, you know, Section 404. And then there was an 89 manual. And, you know, there was like, oh, there's a new manual every 2 years. And, you know, based on the administration, you know, that manual would be more, I guess, you know, generous in terms of, you know, the areas that it was thought were wetlands, and or it would switch to, you know, being less generous. And, you know, it was kind of a, you had this, you know, ecological, you know, kind of changing tide, right? You know, the tide's coming in or it's going out based on, you know, what the regulatory, description of those areas are. And so, you know, I mean, why do you think it's been so hard for us to settle on this definition?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple different reasons. One, you know, the kind of on the science and just the physical reality of it, there's just so many different kinds of wetlands. You know, we have these vernal pools in California that for most of the year and sometimes even for years at a time when we're in the middle of a drought are just dry. They look like a dry patch in the ground, and maybe the grass looks a little bit different to the casual observer. Maybe you see some more exposed dirt, but it kind of looks like the rest of the landscape. And then we get a good rain or we get a good snow and a big snow melt in the spring and those places flood. And all of a sudden you've got shrimp crawling around in there that have hatched out of these eggs, have been sitting in the dirt for years. You got bugs flying all over the place. And all of a sudden it looks a lot like a wetland. And I don't think that's unique. I think there's a lot of places where we see things that don't register as wetlands.
So I'll give you another example. If you happen to be visiting the Texas Hill Country, and you go to Fredericksburg and then go to a state park called Enchanted Rock, a big pink granite rock, which was used to, you know, that's the rock used to make the Texas Capitol. On top of that rock, there are vernal pools. And I've been out there, you know, every once in a while when you get a rainstorm and all of a sudden, you know, these, you know, really cool little pools come to life and they've got this, you know, tiny shrimp in them and all. You know, they're really a kind of amazing ecological feature.
That's so cool. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's part of it, right? Is we just don't recognize some of the time what these places are. I think there's also a tendency of people not thinking about the natural places that they see every day as places that are potentially important. You know, if you've got some land and you know, like, oh, I can't drive my truck down in that one corner for about 2 or 3 months out of the year because I just get stuck if I do, that may be a wetland, right? Because you may have some groundwater coming out there. It's a spot where the surface flows accumulate. And so people just don't often think of it. And so I think when you have places that people don't think of as wetlands, and then those places get regulated, people are kind of caught off guard and often surprised and worried about their property rights and what might happen with their ability to use their land. And so I think it's this combination of kind of understanding what a wetland really is and how broad that definition can be, paired with people's kind of political views about how much regulation private property should be subject to. and kind of a view that like nature is something that happens somewhere else, not here on my property where I'm farming or where I'm living.
Right. And, you know, the other part of that is the benefits that the wetlands, you know, may be creating. I mean, you know, that's one of the things that you hear frequently is, well, the landowner doesn't feel like they're getting any benefit, but somebody downstream may be benefiting in terms of, you know, cleaner water or flood attenuation from that wetland upstream, you know, or some other benefit. And you know, the kind of the way our private property rights system works, you know, the landowner may have that wetland, you know, may feel like, well, I'm not able to develop this area, but I'm not really receiving a benefit. They may not think they're receiving a benefit. And so I know that's all caught up in that issue as well.
Yeah. And I think that's, so in property, we talk about kind of an entitlement, like who's entitled to the benefit of that wetland. Is the person downstream entitled to have a wetland upstream that filters their water and slows floods? Or is the person who owns the land entitled to do what they want with their land and the person downstream just has to take the consequences? And I think that fight is at the core of just an awful lot of disagreements of all kinds that we have about how people use property.
Right.
For everything from wetlands to like how loud your nightclubs can be or how mm-hmm. tall your buildings can be. And so it's something we fight about a lot. And it's a pretty complicated area of law around wetlands and flooding for sure. But kind of going back to this idea of why this is so hard to define, in some ways, like we have fairly clear definitions. You know, the Corps and EPA have those kind of three characteristics that they look for. Right. So look at the vegetation, and if it's hydrophytic, vegetation is a vegetation that you expect to see in a wetland, right? Reeds, right. Cattails, tule reeds out here in California, either hydric soils, those dark soils that smell kind of stinky. So I always, obviously not a soil scientist, but.
But they've got a lot of organic matter in them.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And then hydrology, is it flooded? And so like, at one level, that part of the definition has been stable for a long time. And the big fight, I think, is about even if you identify an area as a wetland or as a dry stream bed or like a really small stream, or if you know it's a ditch that's flooded for part of the year, I think the real question is like, is that actually covered by the Clean Water Act or not, regardless of what we decide to call it? And that piece is been just a disaster for a very long time.
Right. Well, speaking of disasters, so of course, you know, the big news over the last several months has been the, you know, U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Sackett versus EPA. So tell us what the court decided and what you think the impact of that decision was.
Okay, great. So, like I said, this has been a mess for for a long time. So maybe we can back up a little bit and kind of take a running sure. start at it. Okay, so Congress passes Clean Water Act 1972. The goal is to restore and maintain the chemical, physical, biological integrity of the nation's waters. There's kind of two main foci of the Clean Water Act, at least with respect to putting pollution out there, to discharging the pollution. And the two main parts are what we call Section 402 and Section 404. So we talked about 404, which is the dredge and fill materials, and that's kind of administered by the Corps of Engineers. And then the EPA does 402, which is kind of more traditional pollutants, things like chemical waste or sewage or all those things that you might normally think about going back to when the Cuyahoga River caught on fire. All right, so you can't discharge any of those things without a permit. If it's a regular pollutant, then the EPA is going to issue that permit. If it's a 404 dredge and fill material, then the Corps of Engineers issues that permit. The states are able to get authority from the EPA or the Corps of Engineers to issue those permits themselves. And almost all states, maybe all states now, have 402 permitting authority. So if you need a permit to discharge a pollutant like chemical waste or sewage waste or whatever, you go to your state, the state issues you that permit. And when they issue you that permit, that lets you comply with what the EPA requires under 402 at the same time.
Right. That's what. So in Texas, that would be the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality.
Exactly. So, yeah, states had to pass their own laws and spin up their own agencies to do this. But it gives the states a whole lot more control, which is what the states want. So they can kind of decide how they're going to administer their own version of the Clean Water Act at the state level. The core, though, under the 404 piece, very few states have gone out and gotten authority to do the 404 permitting. I think there's two states. I know Michigan's one of them. And so as a result of that, the Corps of Engineers is still the entity that issues almost all the 404 permits. I think this is harder. I think that this is also politically more difficult, and states just don't want to take on that responsibility. And so that stayed with the federal government and with the Corps of Engineers. Okay, so we got 402, we got 404 permits. You have to get a permit before you discharge any of these pollutants, really broadly defined, into what we call navigable waters. And that's the language of the act, navigable waters. It's a legal term, right? And so we want to know what that means. Navigable waters has meant a whole bunch of different things throughout the kind of legal history of the United States. We mean one thing for access for navigation. We mean another thing for when states own the land under rivers and streams. We mean something different when we're talking about public trust doctrine. When can you and I go on a river and float down the river, even if it flows over private property? Right? These are all different areas that use different definitions of navigable water. And so it's not really clear what navigable water means in the Clean Water Act. And Congress put a definition in the act to explain to us what it means. It says it's the waters of the United States, which doesn't really move the ball very much.
Yeah, it could be more specific, right?
Yeah. And so we've, like the EPA and the Corps and the courts all agree that that means that there's some places that are not navigable, in fact, where you have a hard time taking a boat in, that are waters of the United States and so are covered by the Clean Water Act. But where that line is exactly is kind of all over the place. So 1975, Corps of Engineers promulgates a rule that says tributaries of navigable waters. Promulgates means like they develop and they publish a rule. And those rules that the agencies write have the force of federal law, right? So if you violate that rule, it's just like you're violating the underlying Clean Water Act. You could go to jail for violating their rules, just like you would for a regular federal law. So Corps of Engineers promulgates this rule. It says jurisdiction waters of the United States includes normal navigable waters, tributaries of navigable waters, and then wetlands adjacent to navigable waters or their tributaries. In 1985, case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. It's U.S. v. Riverside Bayview Homes. People call it Riverside Bayview. And the question is, in that case, whether these adjacent wetlands, wetlands that are next to a body of navigable water, whether those are covered or not. Right? Is this really a water when it's dry, sometimes when it's got plants growing it, and at all these different things? And the Supreme Court says unanimously, yeah, adjacent wetlands are covered. We definitely include these wetlands that are adjacent to navigable water bodies. Okay, so win for the Corps. Corps of Engineers then with the EPA publishes new regulations in 1986. Is this too much detail? Are you all right with all this?
Nah, I'm good. No, this is good. This is what I want to know.
Okay, cool. Sure. So this is still part of our running start up to Sackett. Right? Okay, so new regulations in 86, and these are a little bit broader, and these include what's called the migratory bird rule. You know, so if you're a hunter, your ears prick up for this. And they're trying to help implement some of the migratory bird treaties, but they're trying to do it under the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act. And they say we're going to include waters that are or would be used as habitat by migratory birds. So birds that are flying around and land in these isolated pools that aren't connected to surface water anywhere else, we're going to go ahead and cover those under the Clean Water Act. They get sued over that. This case goes up to the Supreme Court in 2001, and the case is Solid Waste Agency of Northern Cook County versus the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and people call that SWONC because that's the acronym, right? So SWONC. And the court says, no, you can't cover these isolated, non-navigable intrastate ponds. Like, navigability has to mean something. We're just going to interpret this under the Clean Water Act. And this decision, unlike the first one, is not unanimous. This is a 5-4 decision. Four justices would have said, yeah, this is okay. 5-4, the court says migratory bird rule is unlawful here. All right. So at that point, then the EPA and the Corps of Engineers need a new rule so they can figure out what waters they're going to regulate under the Clean Water Act. They put out kind of an early draft of that. It's called an advance notice of a rulemaking in 2003. But things kind of fall apart and they don't ever get a rule issued. Right. So Corps of Engineers then gets hauled back in front of the Supreme Court in this case called Arapanos. And in that one, they're looking at these Michigan wetlands, and these wetlands are near ditches, and these ditches eventually drain into traditional navigable waters. And the Corps said, well, these are covered because they're connected to these ditches, and then those ditches drain to navigable waters, and that's adjacent enough for us to cover them. And really, like, we have to cover them if we're going to keep the downstream waters clean and healthy the way that the Act tells us to. Arapanos is end up with just a disaster of a decision. Regardless of which side of the issue you're on, the decision gives you like almost no guidance. There's five separate opinions. Right? We've only got 9 Supreme Court justices, and they write 9 opinions. They can't, or 5 opinions, or they can't get closer to having a full opinion than that. And so we end up with a plurality, 4 justices, Scalia, writes for Chief Justice Roberts, Thomas, and Alito. And they say that these jurisdictional waters have to be either traditional navigable waters, waters that are connected to traditional navigable waters by permanent flows, nothing ephemeral or intermittent, or wetlands that are adjacent to those water bodies. And they said wetlands that are adjacent to waters that only flow occasionally don't count. Right? So they're really trying to trim it back. But they've only got 4 votes for that. We got 9 justices, 4 votes isn't enough to give you a controlling opinion. All right. Then you get another 4 who say, hey, we think this is fine. We think these waters are covered. But again, there's only 4 there. Doesn't get you where you need to be. There's a couple other kind of technical decisions that don't, or technical opinions that get written that don't do a whole lot for us. Right. And then we end up with the decision that seems to be controlling after Arapanos, which is by Justice Kennedy. And Justice Kennedy has the controlling vote here because the 4 dissenting justices all said they would agree with Kennedy. Anything that Kennedy thinks is covered, they would also say is covered. So that gives you 5 votes, at least, for Kennedy's position. But Kennedy agreed with Scalia's decision saying that these particular wetlands shouldn't be covered. It gets into some complicated kind of nose counting in the Supreme Court. But Kennedy's opinion ends up as the one that is most likely to control after Arapanos. And what he said is that this intermittent or permanent flow part doesn't matter. We shouldn't pay attention to that. We shouldn't pay attention to like how far things are from a kind of traditional navigable water body. What we should look at is whether the water has a significant nexus to traditional navigable waters. And then the language of the act is, or the language that he used rather, is the wetlands, either alone or in combination with similarly situated lands in the region, significantly affect the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of other covered waters more readily understood as navigable. Some of that language came from Riverside Bayview and from Swank, the earlier decision. Some of that language comes from the act itself, right? We're trying to protect the chemical, physical, and biological integrity. That's the whole goal of the act.
Right.
All right. So he writes this significant nexus test, very fact dependent. If you're somebody who wants to develop a piece of property, it's hard to look at your property and say, does that wetland there have a significant nexus or not? But, you know, the world's a messy place. So Maybe that's kind of all you can do based on the science if you're really trying to achieve those goals. And so the agencies then write a new rule kind of as quickly as they can, trying to put Kennedy's view in. And essentially their rule says anything that Scalia would think is a wetland or anything that Kennedy would think is a wetland and counts for us under the Clean Water Act. They get a big lawsuit filed against them as soon as they write those rules. We have a change in presidential administrations. New administration writes a new set of rules that essentially follows Scalia's much narrower decision. We get another new administration that comes in and they issue another new rule. So we end up with three rules. We get a whole bunch of stays from different courts staying the new rule in different places, all three really of the new rules in different places. I mean, it's just kind of an epic disaster. Yes. Yeah. Nobody, you know, it's very hard for any individual person who wants to figure out if they need a permit or not to go out and get a permit or to decide if they need to get a permit or not. Right. So just a huge disaster. In the midst of all that, the Sacketts are these folks up in Idaho, and the Sacketts have some land that has a wetland, and the wetland's near a ditch that goes into a creek that goes into Priest Lake. And the Priest Lake, everybody agrees, is a navigable water body and would be covered by the act. And so the question is, does this wetland that's next to a ditch that goes into a creek where the ditch itself is intermittent, does that count or not? And this really divides Kennedy's view, which says, well, you look at the significant nexus test and say, does this have a significant nexus with Priest Lake, especially if you count the other wetlands that are similar? Or is this, under Scalia's view, a wetland that's adjacent to an intermittent water body, this ditch, and so it's not covered at all? All right, so they get a determination with the Corps of Engineers that says, yes, this is covered. So they start developing it. Then the EPA comes in and tells them that they need to stop what they're doing and to undo it. They do at some point get this determination. The facts get really messy in there. But finally, they sue, alleging that, in fact, this is not the waters of the United States, right? Trying to say that the newer rule shouldn't apply. The old rule, to the extent that it would count their wetland as a water of the United States, is wrong. And that the Scalia view of what counts is right. Right. So the district court, in her summary judgment for the EPA, says, no, this is definitely a water of the United States. Ninth Circuit affirms using Kennedy's view from Rapinos. And that puts us in front of the Supreme Court, teeing everything up. All right. Does all that make sense?
It was a long journey to where we find out what has just been decided this last spring.
Yeah, exactly. So that comes to Sackett, and then we get this Sackett v. EPA decision from the Supreme Court. And essentially, what Sackett says is that Scalia was right. They essentially embraced that plurality view, maybe even a little bit narrower than that. They say that for a water body, for an adjacent wetland to be jurisdictional, for it to be covered under the Clean Water Act, you'd have to show first that this is the language of the decision, the adjacent body of the water constitutes waters of the United States, right? So that you're actually next to waters of the United States. And then second, that the wetland has a continuous surface connection without water, making it difficult to determine where the water ends and the wetland itself begins. Right. And the net result of that is that an awful lot of wetlands are no longer going to be covered under the Federal Clean Water Act.
So we start out historically with about, what you say, 220 million acres of wetlands. And we're down to what you said, 75 to 100 or?
Yeah. And that's in the continental. If you count Alaska, you end up with a whole lot more. And if you read Sackett, the majority opinion talks a lot about how, you know, it's 200 or 300 million acres of wetlands that are covered. But they're talking mostly about wetlands up in Alaska.
Gotcha.
Way fewer left here.
Gotcha. So the 75 to 100 that we have in the 48 coterminous, is that how you say it, states. I guess, do we have like an estimate of like how much or what percentage of those wetlands are now covered by the Clean Water Act?
Yeah. So the estimate now is that about half of the wetlands no longer have protection.
Okay.
And it depends. you know, you kind of have to look state by state to see the extent of the wetlands that are not protected. That 50% figure does that, right? But someplace like California, in California's version of the Clean Water Act, it's called the Port Cologne Act out here. It's what gives us the power to write the regulations. It says anything that's ever been covered by the Clean Water Act is covered under California law. So kind of think about the maximum that the act's jurisdiction ever grew to, means that these places are still covered here. But for a lot of states just say, we're only going to cover what the Clean Water Act has to cover.
Yeah.
And so that means that these wetlands that are not covered no longer have any protection at all. And there's, you know, so people that hear about this and they're like, okay, so the Clean Water Act doesn't apply. So what? There's a lot of things that the Clean Water Act does for us, right? The most obvious one is that you had to pull a permit before you could fill in these wetlands. And in most cases, that meant you had to go out and do some mitigation, pay for wetland mitigation in a mitigation bank or create some new wetlands somewhere. And that's where people kind of think about it. But there's a whole bunch of other federal laws that get triggered when a federal agency issues a permit, right? So if you're thinking about the Endangered Species Act, the only way that you're going to apply the Endangered Species Act, like in the real world on the ground, in most cases to someone who's developing a piece of property, is when they pull a federal permit for that property.
And they go out and they do, somebody does a field assessment and they determine how you may have endangered species on this property as well.
Exactly. And that's triggered because you need that federal permit. And so the Corps of Engineers says, well, before we can issue the permit, we have to comply with the Endangered Species Act and make sure that we're not going to jeopardize the existence of any endangered species. So they require you to figure out if you've got endangered species or not. And then if you do, they will help you or require you, depending on your perspective, to pull the ESA, the Endangered Species Act permits that you need to do that. Without a Clean Water Act hook, you may not even know that there's endangered species on the property. No one's looking, and it makes it a lot harder to protect those species.
Right.
You also have to do a National Environmental Policy, a NEPA analysis, before you issue a permit. So you'd have to say, you know, it would kind of figure out what the environmental impacts of issuing this permit are going to be. So there's a lot of things that get triggered by the Clean Water Act jurisdiction that just won't get triggered at all anymore. So even in a state like California that does cover these places, you lose out on some of the federal protections that you'd get. And actually, some of our developers here are really unhappy about this because they knew how to work with the federal government on getting these permits. And the federal government had the expertise and had people who'd spent their whole careers writing 404 permits. And now they have to work with the state. And the state doesn't know how to do these, hasn't done these ever. So you've got people who are trying to get up to speed with how they can regulate this at the state level. And then developers who say, can't I just go back and get a federal one and comply that way? And they can't do it. So it's an interesting problem for sure.
That's a surprise to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, it's obviously, you know, we're in a period when flooding and flood related natural disasters are increasing in frequency and severity. And, you know, wetlands are the key for preventing and moderating floods and allowing the destruction of more wetlands, you know, increases the impact downstream of flooding. I mean, that seems like terrible public policy to me. And so, you know, even thinking about wetlands and biodiversity and wetlands storing carbon. I mean, think about climate change and, you know, wetlands are fantastic at storing carbon. And so, you know, it just always comes back to me, why do we have such a, you know, hard time as a nation understanding, responding to the need to, you know, protect the wetlands that we have left, which I guess now 50% of them are all of a sudden unprotected.
Yeah, it's such a hard question. And it's, you know, I think it gets into some bigger things about political leanings and people's motivations and what they value most. But one of the things that I've kind of found just fascinating through this whole process, even before that Supreme Court decision came out, the Walton Family Foundation, the Walmart folks, did a big survey or funded a survey with this group called Morning Consult to look at people's attitudes about wetlands. And most people thought the EPA should still have the authority that it had pre-Sackett. 75% of adults wanted more protection for waters and wetlands. 89% of adults wanted, where we said they'd be worried if people didn't have to meet the same requirements before putting waste into streams or wetlands. 88% said they'd be concerned if you didn't have to have a permit to make permanent physical changes to a place like a wetland. So it's clear that people care about this stuff, right? And that there's even kind of political support for this in a lot of cases. And I think it's not, you know, it's not just your bleeding heart liberals or anything who want these things protected, right? The groups that have done the most to fund wetland conservation in the United States are the hunting groups.
Right. You know,
there's not a self-imposed tax on cameras and binoculars for the people who are out watching birds. It's the people who are actually out hunting these things. So there's a lot of support for wetland protection. I don't think we're going to get it out of our current Congress. And I'm not sure if, you know, in the next 10 to 15 years, there's prospects that Congress will be stop being so broken that they aren't able to take action on things that most Americans here agree on.
Right. Right. Well, you know, and I've heard that there's an effort underway in Congress to come up with some new wetlands legislation. But, you know, I can't imagine that going anywhere. So, you know, I am always struck by this issue of, you know, the balance between rights and responsibilities in the U.S. Constitution. And, you know, for me, wetlands have always been one of the areas where I kind of see this play out. You know, as somebody who's involved with, you know, water and public policy. And, you know, I rarely hear much about landowners' responsibilities regarding how their actions, you know, might impact their neighbors downstream of their properties. You know, you're talking earlier about, folks downstream receiving the benefits of wetlands, and, you know, the property owner upstream, you know, not really receiving any benefit. You know, when you think about it, you know, the law doesn't really seem to recognize that, hey, somebody downstream may be harmed by this action. You know, somebody fills in a wetland and, you know, you're going to have more, you know, flooding downstream, or water quality will be worse downstream. And, you know, they don't seem to really have any legal recourse for that. And I guess that's because it's maybe difficult to calculate what that would be. But, you know, I've always kind of wondered about that kind of element to this debate as well.
Yeah, and this is one that's kind of all over the place, because this is a property issue, and so this is really determined at the state level. Kind of this question of what your property right is with respect to taking out a wetland, you know, ignoring Clean Water Act and all that stuff. What happens if you take out a wetland and it has impacts on your downstream neighbor? The old English rule that everybody used said that basically everybody was on their own. Everybody can build drainage ditches or dikes or whatever, and you're supposed to just deal with it downstream. And that was the initial view in a lot of states here. And that's a rule that's really made just to encourage development as fast as possible upstream, right? Because if you don't have to worry about what's happening downstream, then you go in and you do this development. Most states have moved farther away from that over time. You know, we think about property rights as these things that are just locked in place, but what we recognize as property and the limits of private property and the responsibilities that come along with it, that stuff shifts quite a bit over time. And one of the places is in this way that we treat the floodwaters from one property on another property. And most states now take a reasonableness approach to this. So if your alteration is unreasonable, then in that case, you're going to have liability to your downstream neighbor. And so one part of it is just this kind of legal question about what property we recognize and how that's changed over time. And so in some cases, there it is possible to assign liability for the destruction of a wetland. But the other piece of this is something that you see time and again in environmental law, where the impact from destroying an acre of wetland here or an acre of wetland there is really small. You know, a single little piece of wetland in an entire watershed isn't going to make a huge difference. But if all of your upstream neighbors are doing this, then pretty quickly you're going to be having flooding problems.
Right, right. The cumulative impact of all those changes in the watershed upstream. I mean, you know, here in Texas, you know, there are a number of times where, you know, I've seen situations where there was some real kind of surprise about the magnitude of downstream flooding because it didn't really take into account what had been happening, you know, over the decades since the last big flood upstream. And, you know.
Yeah. And then it gets really hard to figure out, you know, okay, I'm angry because my property flooded and I think it's my upstream neighbor's fault, but I've got 400 upstream neighbors who've all gotten rid of some wetlands on their property.
Right.
So who do I sue and am I going to win? And probably not. You know, it's the same problem when you've got 40 smokestacks that are all down or upwind of you and it's giving you asthma, but you don't know which of those smokestacks is the tipping point. And it's really why you need regulation in a place like that, in order to address those kind of diffuse harms that come from a whole lot of different sources.
Well, where do you think we're heading next regarding the courts and the interpretation of federal wetlands policy? Do you think at some point the pendulum is going to swing back the other direction, or is the pendulum got farther to go in the current direction?
It's so hard to, you know, if you're reading the tea leaves here, this is like reading the tea leaves when you got a lot of cream in the tea and you haven't even drunk it yet. So it's hard to predict where we're going to go. I can kind of give you a quick update on what's happened since the decision. So in September, the EPA put out a final new definition that changed their old definition to comply with SACCET. Essentially knocking out everything about the significant nexus and just embracing the part of it that kind of came from Scalia's decision in Rapinos. So there is a new rule out, and that rule is taking effect in some places. There were a bunch of states that had filed a lawsuit against the EPA, against their old rule. And so in places where that old rule was challenged, those states don't get this new regulatory definition yet. They are still using like a pre-2015 rule as like colored by SACCET. It's really unclear. So this didn't even result in clarity right now. So Louisiana, Texas, a bunch of other states kind of down there, 27 states total challenged a January rule and now are still subject to a pre-2015 rule. So if you're in those states, like, good luck. You have to go and ask the Corps for a jurisdictional determination. And hopefully the Corps will do that. They'd said they're going to stop while they came out with the new standards. I think since September they've started doing that again, but it's not super clear what's covered and what's not covered after SACCET. And I don't think SACCET gives you quite enough to have it be really clear. So there's going to be more district court and circuit court challenges to these rules and to kind of figuring out how we apply them. I've got a colleague over down at USC, Robin Craig, who's done some work on this, and she thinks that there'd be a lot more support for regulating pollutants in wetlands than regulating the fill of wetlands. You know, I can see where she's coming from there. So if somebody's going to go dump some oil or whatever in a wetland, you know that's going to eventually flow down into your river, and you don't want that to happen. And I don't think anybody wants that to happen. And so covering these water bodies for pollutant purposes, but not for 404 purposes, might be possible without changing the act. There's a Supreme Court case from 2020, County of Maui, which said that if there's a discharge into navigable water, or if there's something that's functionally equivalent to directly discharging into navigable waters, then that's going to be covered under the act. And so, you know, maybe putting pollutants into a wetland could be roped in through County of Maui or maybe through some other mechanism. So it's possible we'll get better coverage pollution for pollution. I don't see any changes happening on the fill side, the 404 side, coming out of this Congress for sure. And you know, I don't know what Congress we're going to get next year about this time. So who knows where that's going to go.
Right.
And I don't think we'll see a different interpretation of the act with this Supreme Court. And we've got a lot of young justices. So I don't see that happening anytime soon.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, you know, we're getting towards the end here. So I want to ask you a big philosophical question before we depart. I want to, you know, take, you know, advantage of your unique background. So, you know, Kieran, as a scientist, I'm often frustrated with the law and how it considers or doesn't really consider science, particularly regarding ecology. You know, you have a unique background, as I said, you know, in law and science. I mean, so how do you see the ever-changing relationship between science and law?
It's such a hard relationship. And, you know, in some ways, I think being a good lawyer is a lot like being a good scientist. You study, you read, you learn rules, you try and generalize them. But there's some core differences. And one is that law really wants certainty. And property rights, we want certain property rights. We want to know what we can do and what our neighbors can do and what they can't do and what we can't do on our property. And science just has a hard time fitting into that, right? If we say, well, our goal is to protect clean water. Everybody wants clean water. And then we find out from our scientists, so that means we got to protect our wetlands because like they're the cleaning and protecting part of the whole system. That changes where we thought we were drawing the lines in the Clean Water Act, right? So sometimes you see real wins. I think that case I mentioned earlier, the County of Maui versus the Hawaii Wildlife Fund Clean Water Act case, that was actually about discharging into groundwater, and then the pollutants would flow through the groundwater out to the ocean. And the court said, you know, it looks to us like putting this stuff into the groundwater is just like putting it directly into the ocean, which is kind of a big shift in how courts have understood groundwater. There's always been a view in the laws of groundwater as something really mysterious that we can't understand.
Oh, yeah.
Which can be true, but in this case, at least, it was clear, and the court looked at the science and got it right. This is in 2020, right? This is the same Supreme Court. We got a conservative Supreme Court, well, not almost the same Supreme Court. We got a conservative Supreme Court saying that. So, like, you'll see spots where science really wins. Science is just—it's also complicated and nuanced, and you don't want legislators trying to understand what the science, I mean, you want them to, but you can't expect them to understand what the science says because they're doing so many different things. You know, you'd have to understand ecology. You have to understand all the stuff about air quality. You'd have to understand all these kind of deep scientific questions that people spend whole careers wrangling with. And so legislatures tend to push those questions to the agencies, and the agencies get to make these scientific calls in the first place. So, you know, if you're a scientist or if you really care about these issues, the place to be working the vast majority of the time is in front of the agencies, it's with the agencies, it's commenting on the rules, go work for the agencies. I tell my students all the time, you'll have way more of an impact on public policy if you're working for an agency than if you're on the outside trying to sue them. So,
yeah,
you know, I think the only thing you can do as a scientist is trying to advocate for good science and for your own science and really be involved in the political process, as hard as that is as a science person.
Right. Right. I tell my students something similar, and that, you know, starting out even early in your career, I mean, it's, you know, those are great places to start out, cause you learn so much and you learn how everything works. And if you decide not to make a career working at one of those agencies, but you're still focused on environmental management or policy or something of that nature, you still get a lot of benefit having, you know, spent some time, you know, working as a regulator. So.
Absolutely. Plus, you might get to live in D.C. for a couple of years, and it's a
there
great
you go.
Young person.
That's right. I certainly enjoyed it. But it was expensive. I'll say that.
It's being a poor young person is the only way to survive.
Right. So, well, Kerrigan, our final question for you, or my final question for you is, you know, how can our listeners find out more about your work, what you're doing?
Yeah, so I really appreciate the question. If you just Google Kerrigan, it's K-A-R-R-I-G-A-N, last name B-O-R-K. It'll bring up my UC Davis faculty page, and there's links there. You can also look on the Social Science Research Network for my publications, and that's at bit.ly/BorkSSRN. So bit.ly/BorkSSRN.
Great. Great. I love it. So, you know, Kerrigan, thanks for joining us today. I really enjoyed this conversation. You know, you've got a really great background for, you know, discussing all the ins and outs of wetlands. And, you know, I've been looking forward to this for a while. So thanks.
Hey, thank you. Really a pleasure to chat with you about all this stuff, as complicated and messy as it is. And maybe at some point we'll go out and you can show me how to shoot those ducks.
Yeah. Well, you know, hopefully there'll be some place for the ducks to hang out still. Right. Keep my fingers crossed on that. So this has been Talkless Water. And my guest today was Kerrigan Burke, acting professor of law at the University of California, Davis School of Law. I want to thank you, the listener, for spending your valuable time on this podcast. And finally, I want to give a big thank you to Anna Huff at the Meadows Center for Water and Environment at Texas State University for getting each one of our episodes of Talkless Water ready to go. My name is Todd Bollock. I messed that part up. You know, you think that getting my name right would be like the easiest thing to do in the podcast, but it wasn't. Okay, my name is Todd Bollock. Let's talk water again soon. There you go.
Perfect.